Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Iadarola. We're launching into a Tuesday, a big Tuesday, a big legal Tuesday. And did you really want to sit through an hour of me trying to make heads or tails of the legal situation facing some of our ruling elites, or at least former elites? No, you don't want that. You might have tolerated it. You're very kind people, but we've got something better planned for you. And that is Adrian Lawrence, who returns to the show. Adrian, how's it going?
It's going pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. People have been seeing a lot more of you recently, thanks to your videos on Rebel HQ. Can you tell people about those if they haven't seen already?
Yes, so TYT overruled, covering some legal issues, just giving you the general breakdown of how things work. You know, because once we are fully informed about the process and system, then we can change it. So I love to do that. Check it out, Rebel HQ, Facebook and YouTube.
Awesome, everyone should definitely do that. Thank you to all of you who are here, regardless of what platform you're on. We love you, whether you're on the members app, YouTube, Twitch, stuff I don't know about, stuff the cool younger kids are like, invite me, come on, I wanna know what it is. What's the platform you're on? Is it Parler? I hope it's not Parler, but anyway, we got a lot of news for you. We're gonna be talking about the future of the filibuster, the future of Kayleigh McEnany, equally important stories. And then we've got Rudy Giuliani, which at some point I'm gonna get used to saying, emoluments, which I nailed on the first try. And we've also got Greta Thunberg at Davos. In the past, her addresses to that gathering have been amazing, and I have very high expectations for these. So we've got those coming up for you as well. And a little bit later on, I am gonna be doing an interview with a reporter from Business Insider about the future of the minimum wage, what the Democrats and Joe Biden are planning on doing. That will be posted to the YouTube channel a little bit later on. So definitely look for that in the near future. With that, Adrian, you ready to do this thing?
Let's get it.
Let's do it. Oh, also, let's get that like button, everybody. Please hit that if you haven't already. Apparently, it's a big deal. Look into it, it might be fun. And with that, let's talk about this. Mitch McConnell, you remember Mitch McConnell? He used to be in power, and before that, he basically just spent day after day stopping Barack Obama from accomplishing anything. Well, he's going back to that mode. And in the transition to Democratic control of the Senate, he has been effectively blocking everything, the transfer of power in a variety of different organizations inside of the Senate that are supposed to be naturally transferred over to the party that has a majority control. He had been stopping that, saying, I will stop obstructing when you promise that you will keep the filibuster around so that I can keep obstructing with the filibuster. It was a great deal that he was laying out. Apparently, it's been called off though, but in a way that's not necessarily any more positive for those who want stuff to be accomplished in the Senate. Mitch McConnell said late last night that he had essentially accomplished his goal after two Democratic senators said they would not agree to changing the rules to end the filibuster, which would require a 60 vote threshold to advance most legislation. Without the support of all Democratic senators, a rules change would fail. And it sort of makes sense. I mean, if you want them to promise not to change it and you've got enough votes that they can't change it, you don't need them to promise to not change it effectively. And so he put out a statement saying, with these assurances, I look forward to moving ahead with a power sharing agreement modeled on that precedent. He didn't name the Democrats, but Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema are gonna Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. So there's a pretty good chance it's them. And I love that like he's mercifully agreeing to a power sharing agreement. When they lost the House, they lost the presidency, they lost the Senate, the Dems won everything. Can we please get a little bit of power? But anyway, Adrian, what do you think about this? The back and forth on the filibuster.
It's, you know what, it really shows that Senator McConnell, he overreached in his negotiations here, where he thought that, hey, this argument's gonna work. And as you've observed, it's absolutely nonsensical. And in addition, it really just shows how unwilling and just irrational the Republican Party can be when it comes to actual advancements in our society, and the fact that they're willing to go these great lengths to try to shut those things down. And you know, it's not lost on me the fact that the filibuster is rooted in racism and trying to block any advancements for black people in terms of legislation. And the fact that McConnell really wants to hold on to this, it speaks volumes in terms of the extent of the trash.
Yeah, and my fear is that the trash isn't just on that side. So we have a statement from a spokesperson for Chuck Schumer. And they're very happy, obviously, because the impasse has been surpassed. But they say, we're glad Senator McConnell threw in the towel and gave up on his ridiculous demand. We look forward to organizing the Senate under Democratic control and start getting big, bold things done for the American people. Okay, so that's Justin Goodman. Okay, so good, he threw in the towel, I guess. But he threw in the towel because he thought that he didn't need the towel anymore. He was done with the towel. When you wipe off your forehead, you're done with it. You put it down. It's sweaty now. They're saying they're gonna start getting big, bold things done. But Adrian, are we to believe that there isn't going to be an automatic filibuster on literally every piece of legislation going forward? Like, you still are no closer to getting those big, bold things done unless you get rid of the filibuster. And he seems to be implying that he's got a pretty rock hard confirmation from at least two senators that it's not gonna happen. So I don't know, it feels like we're in a very similar situation that we were under Obama.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's gonna be a precarious situation if something isn't done. And I think that that's one of the kind of shortfalls of the Democrats, the fact that they're not making these moves in advance, anticipating essentially what the Republicans are gonna do. If this were a chess game, we would lose every time, and we continue to lose because we almost play this wait and see if they're going to be logical or if they're going to be professional or engage in decorum and fairness. And then we go, oh my God, they're not doing that. And so it just continues to be this circular engagement of not necessarily being able to effectuate the change that we want as a nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like we're gonna talk a lot about the filibuster going forward because it's important. But like if I could reach like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, so you're watching the show right now, let me talk directly to you. You presumably like taking over the majority in the Senate, right? That's a cool thing because in theory you could pass legislation, you could confirm judges and things like that. But let me ask you this, how long would you like to be in the majority? Because if you'd like it to last about 2 years, I think we could make that happen. I think you could give McConnell your reassurances, the filibuster's never gonna go anywhere. He and the Republicans can block literally everything. None of the crises that America faces can be solved. People can continue to suffer for the next 2 years, and then when the Republicans run on them actually being able to get stuff done, knowing full well cynically that they stopped stuff from getting done, but that's the way politics works, they're gonna kick your butts and they're gonna take back control of the Senate. And I know that I'm in a bubble and I'm not the most intelligent person in the world, but if you're watching this, do you disagree with any of the steps that I just laid out? Does anyone disagree that they're gonna block everything? That if nothing gets done, midterm elections are gonna go the way they always go in dark times? The party in power loses seats. You can't afford to lose even one, so you're gonna lose the majority. I feel like that's reasonable. And so one would have to wonder if this is a plan that Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin are signing on to, do they actually have any interest whatsoever in Democrats continuing control of the Senate? Or is that not actually a priority for them?
Well, I think what a lot of them are masquerading as Democrats. So I don't think it's necessarily a priority for them because the Democrats staying in control is not what they're necessarily focused on. And I think that that's also one of the shortcomings of the Democratic Party, allowing these people to continue to masquerade and to have this faux persona of we have power and control when no, not really. You have these wavering pieces that you can't guarantee what direction they're gonna go in. And unfortunately, as a result of that, hanging your hat on the thought that we're gonna make some bold, you know, true progressive moves, it's like, really? Because the last time I checked, you were not actually in power, that is something that's more of a facade.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like when we're talking about potential rules changes, reforms to the way the Senate works or other aspects of government, like people will evaluate those with this sort of mythic idea of what American government is and how it's functioned. And they just think, oh, well, you know, the filibuster, it's in the Constitution, it's been around for hundreds of years. None of that is true, of course, but they think that. And they think, well, it's really important to get this done. I mean, after all, didn't you like the filibuster being around when the Democrats were in control? And that's true. And I understand that on a shallow level, that might seem hypocritical, but I would ask you to look into what was being blocked with the filibuster. What the actual position of the majority of Americans were on the things the Democrats were blocking when they were on the minority, and the things that the Republicans will be blocking now that the Democrats have taken control of government. And I know that like it's been around a long time, any sort of big structural change to American government shouldn't be rushed into, surely. But I would argue that getting rid of the filibuster today is hardly rushing things. The filibuster today is not what the filibuster was 50 years ago, and it certainly wasn't what it was 150 years ago since it didn't even exist then. Like 50 years ago, there was not an assumption that literally everything, including being able to choose the chairman of Senate committees, would be automatically filibustered, that every judge would be automatically filibustered. Now we've moved past that, member that we've already shown that you can chip away at the filibuster, but that is not what it was. You used to have to actually stand up, occupy the floor, potentially draw public scorn for your position. Now they don't have to do any of that. They can stand against a raise to the minimum wage, COVID aid, Green New Deal, whatever you want, and they don't really have to filibuster it. They just check a box and then they walk away, they go home and they raise more money. Like, we're getting rid of the filibuster might seem extreme, but I would argue that the current situation is as extreme, but it's extreme in a way that is stopping the government from actually solving any problems. And the people have voted multiple times in every way they can to try to put people into government who will try to finally do something. The Republicans had their chance. They didn't want it because they don't consider those problems to be actual problems for the people they represent, who are the wealthy, who aren't bothered by those problems. So it's complex. We're going to be talking about it a lot. But I would just argue to keep an open mind if you want anything to happen in the American government over the next 2 years.
I don't think you're asking, Adrian, for too much. You're not asking for too much. You know, and it's a poor analogy, but I think it's all rooted in the same thing. The terms or the reality that the filibuster was not part of the original design of the Senate, yet it came in as a result to block any progress for people of color when it comes to legislation. And just the fact that it's still around and it is abused and people can just do it so easily, it kind of reminds me of all the other issues involved in our government that arise out of ways to oppress marginalized groups, like the fact that marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, and the fact that, you know, hey, it was condemned and determined to be illegal because it was rooted in racism. And all of these things that we say, nope, it's part of American fabric. Oh, it's law, it's this and that. It's like laws are meant to be changed, and they should. Mm-hmm. They need to evolve with society. So the same thing when it comes to rules and getting rid of arcane practices that are used to hold us back into points in time which we are no longer in existence.
Exactly, exactly. And by the way, if you're concerned out there that, well, if you get rid of it, then the Republicans won't have to abide by it when they retake control. I got news for you. The Republicans have never been constrained by any rules or norms in getting what they wanted done. They did with the filibuster existing when they had control. The thing they wanted was tax cuts for billionaires. And then they were pretty much done. There's other stuff that hypothetically they might have wanted to get done, but that was their only legislative priority, and they got it done despite the filibuster existing. So that's another fear that I don't really think is warranted. And to Adrian's point, if Ted Cruz wants to stand up for 60 hours and filibuster the legalization of marijuana by reading Dr. Seuss or whatever, more power to him. He can do that, and the American people can turn against him because there is overwhelming support for legalization. These are the sorts of things that if you want to really filibuster, then really filibuster. And if you don't really want to filibuster, then let's just get rid of it. But anyway, before we move on to questions from the audience, Adrian, I wanted to ask you just a couple of quick casual questions that I've seen popping up in chat that I don't know anything about, but that you might. So there are some concerns about pardons recently. I've seen questions in our pre-show about two different areas, and I'm just curious, just off the cuff, your thoughts about one, that secret pardons might have been given. There are people who think, well, it's just too suspicious that Trump didn't pardon himself or his family. So could he in theory have done a pardon, but it doesn't have to be public?
Yes, that is correct. The thing is, okay, so once again, when I say that is correct, I'm referring to something that has no precedent, as in no case law, no courts have interpreted it in terms of the full extent of the presidential pardon. So there is a lot of room there for it to be analyzed or the conclusion to be different. But under what we do have in terms of conversations or history in terms of the pardon, we do see that there's the possibility that secret pardons could have been given, and that all they have to do is bring it up when it comes to being prosecuted and say, hey, I have this piece of paper and it actually says, and it's signed by the president, that I shouldn't be charged for these crimes. And then, of course, the courts then could decide whether that's legit or not. But as of right now, yeah, that easily could have happened.
So you're saying we won't know for sure until they try to get them on some of these things?
Correct.
Interesting. Okay. Well, any lawyers watching this, feel free to try to sue the president. I'm down for that. The other question is, and this was apparently raised by the YouTube channel Legal Eagle, that some of the pardons, including Steve Bannon, might not stick. That there might be something about those pardons that still allows Steve Bannon to be pursued on some of these charges. Have you heard anything about this? That some of the pardons might not have either been written in a certain way, or that there might be some loopholes that allow those people to still be charged?
Okay, so once again, there is no precedent for it, but I have read analysis out there that would suggest that pardons can be, whether they're revoked or they can in some way be undermined by virtue of how they were given. For example, if they were given as part of a bribe, a quid pro quo, that it would impact the enforceability of the pardon. But then again, we'd have to have a court say that, because as of right now, what we do have on the books is a court saying that the pardon power is vast and the constitutional limitations are the only terms in which they are limited. And so what we would need is a situation in which the matter comes before the courts and the courts make that assessment.
Okay, interesting. Okay, so we're gonna have to keep an eye out. That's what I had sort of feared. But hey, look, I personally, I've said many times, I don't think many of these people are gonna suffer really any consequences, but good to know that it's at least possible. And it's good to have someone with this sort of expertise. Thank you as always, Adrian.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We've been on the lookout for which members of the Trump administration are gonna very casually slide into roles in the media. And it looks like Kaylee's first out the gate. Guess where she's going? It's Fox. You know it was gonna be Fox, and it is Fox actually. According to her termination financial disclosure report, Kaylee McEnany reached an agreement with Fox News in January 2021 to start working there this month. Interestingly, she apparently signed on to that before the inauguration. But wait, Trump was still gonna be president at that point. There was gonna be a smooth continuation of power. Everybody believed that the storm was coming and this thing was gonna be overturned, but she was looking to the next step in her career. Not a true believer, Kaylee McEnany. But anyway, Adrian, Kaylee McEnany is gonna go from informally working for Fox News as press secretary to formally getting a paycheck. That's a nice upgrade for her, I think.
I think it's a great upgrade indeed. And it's interesting because as I just saw this tweet come across, that according to Yashar, and a Fox News spokesperson had told him that Kaylee McEnany is not currently an employee, a source familiar with the matter told us, "We are open to hiring her in the future, given we do not condone cancel culture." So if anything, it makes me think that maybe they already have an agreement in terms that they just haven't signed the contract, so it's not gonna be totally illegitimate, but that maybe she's taking her, "I'm gonna take a month off," and then all of a sudden she'll have a desk at Fox News. Mm-hmm. I would not doubt it.
Yeah, look, they can put out a statement, sure. And then we, as reasonable people, can evaluate how much faith do we put in the words of, on the one side, Fox News, on the other side, a professional liar.
Wait, but that's actually, aren't they the same?
That's the same. Yeah.
I'm confused. Professional liars versus a professional liar with highlights.
Exactly. And they're good highlights, you know, admittedly. Here's the interesting thing. And this is, by the way, not gonna stop them in any way from getting her a job or whatever. But just going back to the week after the election, take a look at this interesting little interaction between Kaylee McEnany and Fox News.
"We want every legal vote to be counted. and we want every illegal vote.
I just think we have to be very clear. She's charging, the other side is welcoming fraud and welcoming illegal voting. Unless she has more details to back that up, I can't in good countenance continue showing you this. I want to make sure that maybe they do have something to back that up. But that's an explosive charge to make, that the other side is effectively rigging and
Yeah, it's an explosive charge. It's a charge Fox News thinks they desperately need to get back viewers from OAN and Newsmax. So they go from cutting her off because she's lying too badly to, and look, they're saying not giving her a job. I'm going to say, shut up, I don't care. They're definitely giving her a job. She's definitely going to be there. And not just her, but others as well. Stephen Miller will be a consultant or whatever. They go from cutting her off to she's going to be like commenting, maybe doing a Sunday show or something. Like, do we think that that's not possible?
Oh, I think it's completely and totally possible. And you're absolutely right in terms of the fact that we have these news outlets that are, less than reputable. And they want to take advantage of the fact that Trump created a cult out there. And that cult is going to need to continually be fed. And they are going to give their eyes, their time, their viewership to outlets that will continue to feed into the lies that they've been told. And thus Fox News will look for every opportunity to cater to that. And thus using their money to secure all sorts of Trump cronies and supporters and propaganda machinists. Like, that's exactly what they're going to do. So It's going to be a source, and they're going to continue to go there.
And by the way, it ain't even that big of a difference from her normal schedule. While she was working in the Trump administration, she regularly appeared on Fox, obviously, but she appeared more than 20 times after the November election. Like, that's every couple of days she was already appearing. I guess she was laying the groundwork. She was interning effectively, and then she parlayed that into a job once she was ready to move on. And they won't bow to cancel culture. One of my biggest frustrations with humanity, I guess, is that words can't exist. Like, you have a word that means something, and then people get it, and people are awful, and you can't trust them, so they take the word and they make it to mean whatever they want. I saw that Fox News had a discussion this morning about how people were trying to cancel Andrew Jackson. He's been dead for like a century and a half.
Yeah, isn't he like on the $20 bill or something?
Yeah. Like, well, I'm sure that's what it was about. Probably it was replacing him on the $20 bill. It's canceling someone who's dead. And by the way, totally deserves it. If I could dig up his body and kick it around a little bit, few humans have done more work to earn it than him. But that isn't what cancel culture is, except that now it is. It is whatever Fox wants it to be. Any sort of criticism, anything is cancel. Matt Gaetz said that impeachment is the zenith of cancel culture.
Oh my God, accountability, any kind of consequences or cancel culture for the privileged. Get the hell out of here. Nobody has time for these lies. Just take your L and go.
Exactly, and he doesn't even believe it. He had tweeted 3 years after Obama was gone. He tweeted, you can actually impeach a president after no longer president. Because he thought something Obama, like definitely. It wasn't the zenith of cancel culture for some reason back then. But now it is. It's just, it's so frustrating. Like they definitely believe that it is their right and their duty to criticize people they disagree with. But if that suddenly becomes anything other than a one-way road, then it is justified, patriotic, eagle bearing criticism and cancel culture. That's all it is. It doesn't mean anything. It's political correctness. It's just they have to come up with a new term for I don't want you to speak about me. That's all it is. Anyway, let's move on to a little bit more legal stuff and see what we can learn about the future legal threats to the president. One of the hopes that many people had for possible legal consequences to Donald Trump for the variety of things that he did while president, which by the way, aren't just encapsulated in his support for what happened on January 6th. You'll be shocked to find out he did lots of other bad stuff before that. But one area, the violations of the Emoluments Clause, might be closing up because the Supreme Court just yesterday put an end to two lawsuits that had accused President Donald J. Trump of violating the Constitution's emoluments clauses by profiting from his hotels and restaurants in New York and Washington. There were no dissents noted. So they apparently said that he's not the president anymore, so it's moot. So Adrian, what do you make of that?
Oh, they're punting. They don't want to decide the issue. They could have easily continued to decide the issue, especially because it may turn on potential illegality. It was ripe and before them, but they decide, no, we're going to just wait and call it moot. Because the thing is that appellate courts can operate on their own schedule. So they could have decided this while he was in office, but they've opted not to. They waited on a lot of these cases so they don't have to decide the issue, so they can punt. And as we've recently seen with Chief Justice Roberts, the fact that he is not going to preside over the second impeachment trial, it says that they are trying to divorce themselves from Donald Trump, even though they need to go ahead and play a role and do their jobs. It's like you've been given one of the highest jobs in the nation. Also, it's a lifetime appointment, yet you are punting on things because you are afraid. That is problematic.
Yeah. And we should bear in mind that one out of three of them are there because of Donald Trump. But that said, some of the others who weren't, the more liberal justices, they apparently also didn't have a problem with this. So are you at all surprised to find out that we didn't get a Sotomayor dissent or anything like that?
No, I'm not particularly surprised because I think they just don't want to touch these things. The fact is that generally not, showing any hands here, but in chambers, they sit around and talk about, hey, how are we going to decide this? Where do we want to go with this? And so if they all can get on board on certain things and they can agree, especially not to have anyone dissent so it can look like they're operating as one unified body, that's the better way to go. And so the thing is, that's a lot of politics that actually go into the appellate court process. And the fact that people may make concessions here, but there may be instances where they're unwilling to make concessions, and thus we get these riveting dissents like we've seen from Justice Sotomayor a lot lately. And so this could have been a product of negotiations.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's at least two things that are potentially frustrating to any individual about this. So one is that I personally think, maybe I'm being unreasonable, feel free to dislike the video if you think so. If the Emoluments Clause is to mean anything, he definitely violated it in a variety of different ways. If the design was, we're worried that people will pay off the president and that will influence things. Well, first of all, I'm with you. I would also apply that to all of our other elected officials, but I get it. We're limiting it to the president in the Constitution. So him not having the consequences, I think people can be rightfully annoyed by that. But let's say that you even set aside that and you forget about Donald Trump. It seems like the big issue was that we don't know exactly what we're supposed to think about the Emoluments Clause, what actually is a violation of it. And so they're punting on it. So Adrian, are we any closer to in 4 years when President Hawley starts getting checks written directly to him, do we have any better idea of what the Emoluments Clause is, what its limitations are? Are we any more prepared to adjudicate these things in the future?
Nope. And that's part of the problem. And not having that precedent out there, we're not going to really have a track record, have a model to understand the extent of these clauses that are constitutional, some are statutory. But when the court punts, we all end up losing. I get that there are instances in which issues are moot without question. But then there are issues that can also be reoccurring. We saw that in Roe v. Wade and the fact that, hey, you can get pregnant again. So just because maybe she's not pregnant right now doesn't mean that this issue won't come up again. And so the fact that we need to have these decisions, these interpretations out there to guide us, those are things a court is supposed to do. And so in instances where they punt, where they could legitimately decide the matter, it really deprives us all. Plus also something we should remember about this case is that, Maryland, DC, and several of the restaurants had filed this lawsuit. And what they were looking for were documents. They were trying to get access to information that was being essentially withheld from them so that they could make an assessment of whether Trump is violating the clause here. And now they can't get those things. So if anything, really, it's that SCOTUS is effectively almost impeding the potential for justice. And that's not cool.
Yeah. Obstruction's big in DC. I guess they just want to be in on it. But anyway, what do you think about the possibility of some sort of law actually being passed to try to define it? Whether because that would actually do the job, or else a challenge to that law might at least compel the Supreme Court to do something?
Yes. It would be great if There was a law passed for the emoluments clause, as well as a lot of the clauses, including the constitutional pardon power, things that would define them clearly a lot more, the extent of them. But I really don't know necessarily if Congress has really the strength in it to make any true substantive changes for the betterment of our country. Because the thing is, there is so much just uncertainty out there and ambiguity in our laws and in our code. And without having that guidance there, it allows that the system can be abused by those who are in positions of power. And unfortunately, I think that some people want to continue on with that.
Yeah. We should just strip it out of the Constitution. If it's not gonna mean anything and we're not gonna define it, let's stop pretending it's there. It's like it would be reassuring to have a security system on your house, but if you open it up, it's full of Play-Doh. Maybe it's best to not have the case there in the first place. I know, very frustrating. Let's see, I'm getting a news alert from Bart that there's good breaking news. What do we got? Okay, according to Public Citizen, Biden is ordering his Department of Justice to end private prison contracts. This is huge.
Whoa.
Okay, I need to look at what the actual text is that, because I saw something earlier today that he was gonna be sort of halting military arms transfers to police and limiting private prison contracts. If they're ending them all?
Oh my goodness, that's a whole game changer.
Okay, he's ordering his Department of Justice not to renew contracts with private prisons, one of multiple new planks of his broad focused racial justice agenda. He's poised to sign 4 additional executive actions. Vice President Kamala Harris will be there, aimed at combating discriminatory housing practices, reforming the prison system, respecting sovereignty of tribal governments, and fighting xenophobia against Asian Americans, especially in light of the COVID pandemic. I mean, that all sounds good.
Yeah, like I hate to get too excited in the moment, but oh my goodness, like even just the thought that he won't be renewing these contracts with these private prisons. Of course, I'd like to know when the contracts end, because if they're like decade long contracts, then it's like, okay, that's cute. But you know, the fact is that privatization in prisons are problematic, because all of these, you know, government institutional systems, they're encouraged to go ahead and get more people for these prisons because they're getting paid more, and the kickbacks that they're getting from you know, prison companies, owners and whatnot. It is problematic because it becomes essentially this farming system. And who do they choose? People who look like me. And that is not something that we want to continue. And so changing that would be great, and removing that privatization element, that could be huge.
Yeah. I'm not seeing anything specifically about how long the average contracts are. I mean, I'm hoping it's not like toll roads where it goes until like the year 3000 or whatever. It says they're not gonna be doing it. He apparently also campaigned on it. I'm gonna admit, I honestly didn't see that he had pledged to end private prisons. I'm surprised by that. I guess that was maybe a blinder that I had. They're saying that the motivating factor was the fact that private prisons are not only encouraged profiteering off of human lives, but more importantly, subpar in terms of safety and security. It's not a thing to save money, it's because they're terrible sort of by design, and they certainly are. And think about how many people got COVID in some of these facilities. Look, a lot of it's gonna be in, we need to see the actual data. None of these reports that I'm seeing talk about when the actual agreements that they currently have are up. But sounds good.
And something also to note is that Kamala Harris had said in 2019, she had tweeted out, let's be clear, private prisons are making money off of the incarceration and suffering of human beings. One of my first acts of business as president will be to begin phasing out detention centers in private prisons. So this may very much be something that she is advocating for, and thus Biden will sign off on, which I fully welcome.
Good. I'll take it. I am, like many people watching the show, probably pretty naturally suspicious of the administration, but I'm also not one of the people that's gonna like stick my head in the sand when there's good news. We have been trying everything we can over the last week. We're getting them credit for everything where credit is due, and credit has been due in a number of areas. This one sounds very good. We just have to see the actual text, and we have to get an analysis from places like Public Citizen about how fast this would phase in. What's going to be done with the people who are currently held there? There's a lot of follow-up questions, but it's good news. I don't wanna speculate too much. Rudy Giuliani is facing a massive lawsuit from Dominion Voting Systems, probably having to do with the fact that for a couple of months he's been lying brazenly about them on cable news, in courtrooms, in text, all sorts of things. And so now we have a 107-page lawsuit filed in the federal district court in Washington, accusing Mr. Giuliani of carrying out a quote, viral disinformation campaign about Dominion, made up of quote, demonstrably false allegations, in part to enrich himself through legal fees and his podcast. Wait, is grift illegal now? We might be entering a brave new world. But anyway, they seek damage of more than $1.3 billion. And they've based this lawsuit apparently on 50 different statements that Mr. Giuliani made at legislative hearings, on Twitter, on his podcast, in hardware stores, in massage parlors, and in conservative news media. I might have added a few, you figure out which. Where he spun a fictitious narrative of a plot by one of the biggest voting machine manufacturers in the country to flip votes to President Biden. Okay, so we're gonna have his response in just a second. But Adrian, he is facing this lawsuit, a defamation lawsuit, for a lot of money. What do you think about that and about that dollar value they've applied to it?
So I think the dollar value is definitely somewhat exorbitant, and it is a way in terms of getting people's attention. But I can definitely see the value in this case. You know, it's a 107-page lawsuit that details how Giuliani was essentially advocating and pushing these lies that they believe will and has hurt their business. And the thing is, defamation suits are difficult to win, but we also have to bear in mind that this lie played out on the public stage and in the national arena, international to some extent. It was part of adding to the divisiveness of our nation, and this lawsuit is filed in DC federal court. So you are gonna have a jury pool of people who had to live this out, who had to watch the Capitol before them, some living blocks away, be stormed and had to feel unsafe and have had National Guard around the city, in addition, and the fact that they're gonna be there also till March. So their lives have been disrupted to the nth degree. And so they might be in that jury box wanting to hold someone accountable, and it damn sure could come down on Rudy Giuliani.
And I'm assuming, like, when they ask for like 1.3 billion, that's designed so that in the end they get 1/1000th of that or something like that, usually, right? It ends up being a small fraction of that total amount, if it's successful even.
Generally, in most lawsuits, they don't ask for such a high amount. And this is something because they know that the media, it's gonna gain attention, even though this is the second lawsuit they filed, the first going against Sidney Powell. But they do wanna hype up this attention. And so, and Giuliani made that observation, and I think that that is accurate and correct. But also, you know, it's like negotiation. If you go before a jury seeking 1.3 billion, they could laugh at you, but maybe they'll give you 200 million. And that's not that bad.
Yeah, by the way, Joe Biden and Senate Democrats, these are some important 101 level negotiation tips. Maybe don't enter in at something below what you've already promised if you wanna end up with anything even remotely good. Okay, so you noted that defamation lawsuits are hard to prove. Even with my, you know, stupid version of legal knowledge, I agree. It seems like in this case though, he's made a lot of statements. He's made them very publicly. He has entered into like legal challenges to the election based on these statements. Mm-hmm. They have become incredibly popular. Like lots of right wingers now believe these things, although I don't know that you could trace that directly back to him because he was hardly the only one. And they're suing, you know, Sidney Powell and some others as well. Does this seem like there might be some elements to this that might be a little bit easier to prove than your average defamation lawsuit?
Oh, absolutely. The fact that he did do it on a public stage, the fact that we did see it play out and it did impact our society and people seeing the riot and storming of the US Capitol and having that really that experience resonate with them. Again, they're going to want to hold someone accountable. Also, the fact is that Giuliani is an attorney and he was once a very accomplished one, so he knows better. Yet he was promulgating this lie. And so again, someone will want to hold him accountable or hold someone accountable. And Giuliani could just be it, because again, if Trump won't be held accountable for his actions, there may be a jury pool of people who say, hey, you need to be held accountable. Also, the fact is that Giuliani ignored cease and desist letters and requests for retraction. So he had plenty of opportunities to act right, get right, and do right. And now he is going to be held accountable in a situation of even if he ends up paying a lot of legal fees, he's going to sit, you know, he's going to have to sit with this one.
And he didn't get a pardon from the president. Oh, the most loyal man in the world didn't get a pardon. Let's talk briefly about some of what Giuliani alleged about Dominion that resulted in this $1.3 billion lawsuit. So again, bear in mind, he is not the only person that made these claims. He's also not the only person that is facing a lawsuit. But he was one of the president's allies that contended that the voting machine company, which was also used in states during Mr. Trump's victory in the 2016 election, fact that they conveniently forget, has been tested by government agencies and was used in states Mr. Trump carried in 2020, was somehow involved in a rigged election, partly as a result of ties to a long deceased Venezuelan dictator. So this is where it gets fun. The suit says Dominion was not founded in Venezuela to fix elections for Hugo Chavez. It was founded, they need to say that. It was founded in 2002 in John Poulos's basement in Toronto to help blind people vote on paper ballots. So they go on to say, not only have these lies damaged the good name of my company, this is Mr. Poulos, but they also undermine trust in American democratic institutions, drowning out the remarkable work of elections officials and workers who ensured a transparent and secure election. The thousands of hand recounts and audits that prove machines counted accurately continue to be overshadowed by disinformation. There are so many things in that I am going to assume you could find out the truth about with 35 seconds on Google about when it was created, why it was created, as well as where it had been used. It had been used in 2016 when he won. It was used in states that he won in 2020. But none of that is convenient if you are desperately trying to overturn an election. So they cast that aside. But making such insane statements that it was created at the behest of some dictator who's been dead for a long time, I don't know. Does that make it easier to prove that the statements are so specific and repetitive and extreme? Or does the severity of this statement not matter? I actually don't know much about this area.
Oh, definitely. So when it comes to defamation, it can't be something that is just hyperbole or in any way fluid and non-concrete. It must be a fact. And Giuliani was stating these things as though they were fact. And so that goes really well for Dominion in showing that clearly this man was not pretending, you know, he was not out here using hyperbole or, you know, suggesting in any way that he's just, hey, I'm speaking off the cuff, it's just opinion. No, he was speaking as it was fact. And also he was doing it in his official capacity as a representative of the Trump campaign or just Trump's lawyer or whatnot. So he does come from a position of authority and he was using his voice on these widespread platforms. He knew better, like you've noted, the fact that you can Google this information and find this out, but he did not heed any of that. And also too, where was the basis for these conclusions that he were presenting as fact? And so he's gonna have the opportunity to show that. Exactly. And so I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, these individuals end up in a situation where Giuliani claims to have some kind of mental health issue, something to kind of evade the fact that he was just coming up with these statements that really have no basis in any way, because it is wild.
Mm-hmm. Wait, what if the Four Seasons Total Landscaping was the beginning of crafting a legal defense? Did you see the crazy stuff I got up to? Did you watch Borat 2?
I'm gonna, you know, and the thing is when it comes to like a civil suit, if he does end up saying, you know, hey, I have these mental health issues, dementia, whatever, that can go into maybe the level of the jury verdict in terms of how much money. Maybe they feel a little bit bad for him, so they only give Dominion 2 million instead of 200 million. These things can play a role, but Giuliani, he's a known huckster. So hopefully they don't believe anything he has to say.
Okay, let me ask you one last question about this, because he potentially, as you said, is probably not facing any kind of $1.3 billion fine, but might be facing some sort of massive fine. And he wasn't pardoned by the president, but he was doing it at the behest of the president. Is there the possibility that that becomes a part of the defense? Like in the same way the Capitol rioters are all saying, hey, I was just doing what my president told me. I know he's really loyal and all that, but is there a chance that, is that some sort of defense in a defamation lawsuit that you were doing it for your legal client?
No, you still can't be out here necessarily. You know, it gets a little bit dicey when it comes into the legal representation arena, because there are lawyers who are out here who say we look forward to proving this and that. but also they're very skilled with their words so that they don't end up engaging in defamatory behavior. And Giuliani did not do that, that he was continually pushing this message that was the big lie, as Dominion calls it. And something that I could easily see Giuliani pushing is the fact that Fox News, I believe there was a judge out there that says nobody takes it seriously in terms of Tucker Carlson and what he has to say. And so Giuliani is probably gonna say the same thing in terms of going like, oh, I was just kidding. There was nothing to it. I wasn't speaking in terms of facts, that it was just things, you know, I was making up. I was just sharing my opinion or thoughts. And people should have understood that because it was so extreme. And so I can very much see him making that argument as well.
Okay. Well, we might get a chance to see. That might end up being entertaining. With that, why don't we move into our last story, which I think starts with this video.
We understand that the world is complex and that change doesn't happen overnight. But you've now had more than 3 decades of blah, blah, blah. How many more do you need?
I'm gonna guess like 50 years or so is how much they'd probably like. But anyway, that's Greta Thunberg. And that is her address to the now digital version of the Davos agenda. She delivered this speech as she has for a few years. This is the first virtual annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. And her addresses there have been, I think, a great opportunity for people who don't necessarily always tune into these international like meetings that bear on climate change and the reactions of different states to it, to once again recommit to care about this and to expect more. That is the, like, there's lots of environmental activists, there's lots of ones who do amazing work. One of the things that she does very well is she has never allowed herself to be co-opted by any of these governments, nor easily bought off or artificially impressed by the promises that they've made about supposed deadlines and supposed carbon capture and all that stuff. So I want to give you a little bit of her address. The full speech, which is about 5.5 minutes long, is available. You can easily find it online. But here are a few of the parts that I thought was important for our audience to see.
My name is Greta Thunberg, and I'm not here to make deals. You see, I don't belong to any financial interest or political party, so I can't bargain or negotiate. I'm only here to once again remind you of the emergency we are in. The crisis that you and your predecessors have created and inflicted upon us. The crisis that you continue to ignore. Today, we hear nations and leaders all over the world speak of an existential climate emergency. And yet, instead of taking the immediate action you would in any emergency, they set up vague, hypothetical, distant targets way into the future. Targets based on loopholes and incomplete numbers. Targets like net zero emissions 2050. Targets that equal surrender. It's like waking up in the middle of the night, seeing your house on fire, and then deciding to wait 10, 20, or 30 years before you call the fire department, while labeling those trying to wake people up alarmists.
Okay, so I certainly have thoughts, but Adrian, I want to give you a chance to comment.
Oh, well, just like the intensity. Oh, good God, you know, it felt like it was Liam Neeson in Taken. Like she was just throwing it down. And the thing is, she speaks facts and she's absolutely right. I just hope that people actually listen and do something about it. Because it is problematic that we have capitalism in control of essentially watching our world be torn apart by our desire to have more, more, more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love it. Everyone should definitely watch the full video. I'm gonna read one little quote in a sec. But the thing is, she's been doing now for years, and I'm glad that she's there, that she's doing this. She's gonna be consistent on this probably for the rest of our lives. So she's doing what she can. What we have to do is replace all of those leaders, because the thing is, she's going to address, you know, leaders from around the world at the WEF. And what they're gonna do is continue to try to buy time. Whether because they're like 100% corrupt, you know, and receive money from the fossil fuel industries, or they just believe, well, I mean, we can't do anything crazy, like these things take time, like that sort of complacency that while you pretend to acknowledge the emergency, but you act as if it's clearly not an emergency for you, and you pretend to care about what happens to your kids and grandkids, but obviously based on your actions, you don't give a damn what happens to them, they're gonna continue to do that. And so we can try to put pressure on them, and we should. Maybe we can get something out of that, but we also need to start replacing them. And we're gonna turn in a little bit to America, but this isn't just an American problem. We also need better leadership in the UK and Germany and China and Russia and all over the world to get this done. And so what I am hoping is that while we in America can be inspired by her, I really do hope that not only Greta, but also figures like her, you know, operating in all parts of the world are successful in getting people to make this not just a consideration when they choose what leaders to support, which that was a big war, even to have it be a thing that's on people's minds, but for it to be the driving force in supporting one candidate over another, people who are actually going to prioritize this sort of thing.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were asking me that question. I completely.
Oh, no, I'm not asking. I was
all with you. I was like, what's he need from me?
But yeah, absolutely.
It's completely and totally something that needs to be done, and we need action to be taken. All I can do is hope people listen.
Let me leave people with one last comment that sort of loops back to the beginning of that video that we saw. She says, and again, I'm not telling you what to do. After all, safeguarding the future living conditions and preserving life on Earth as we know it is voluntary. The choice is yours to make, but I can assure you this, you can't negotiate with physics, and your children and grandchildren will hold you accountable for the choices that you make. How's that for a deal? That's a good close.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're gonna see what happens. Maybe new promises will be made. Hey, we're back in the Paris Climate Accords, which is good. And it would be great if it was nearly enough to actually deal with the problem, but it's a start, it's a start. Now, what is Biden going to do when it comes to climate change? Well, he is giving us signals that he prioritizes it. He has brought people into his administration that have, you know, backgrounds in climate science or in dealing with it. Some of his initial day one executive orders have been pretty positive, shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline. He apparently is going to be protecting Anwar and a number of other things. But there is more that can be done. And actually, one possibility that we had talked about close to 2 years ago as something that a future Democratic president could do was brought up in a recent interview by Rachel Maddow of Chuck Schumer. Here's what he had to say.
Describe to me new Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's main legislative priorities. Obviously, we have some things that are not legislative technically, the impeachment of the president, the new president's cabinet.
Can I say one other thing on climate?
Please.
I think it might be a good idea for President Biden to call a climate emergency.
Why?
Because then he can, it relates to what you're saying. Then he can do many, many things under the emergency powers of the president that wouldn't have to go through, that he could do without legislation. Now, Trump used this emergency for a stupid wall, which wasn't an emergency. But if there ever was an emergency, climate is one. So I would suggest that they explore looking at climate as an emergency, which would give them more flexibility. After all, it's a crisis. It's a crisis.
Okay, so he's saying that this is a possibility. And like I said, we had talked about when Trump declared the emergency at the southern border, that that's the sort of power that can be used, you know, in a different direction under another president. So Adrian, what do you think about that as a possible way to deal with some of the obstruction?
It's an excellent way to deal with it. The thing is it is an emergency. It's just not impacting wealthy white people. We have black and brown people who are forced to live in segregated areas of cities where they are exposed to pollutants and to toxins, and it impacts their lungs. And that's why we see high rates of death for black and brown people from COVID-19. And also research shows that black people in terms in the United States, they end up consuming 50% more of the pollution than they actually generate as a community. And so there are people out there already suffering and experiencing it. And just because they're not wealthy or white doesn't mean that it's not a problem. We are all part of the United States and our voices should be heard, and we should also be protected under the law and have our leaders take these steps necessary to end these things that are going on that are eventually gonna hold us all back and hurt us all.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, look, it certainly is an actual emergency. If it makes it a little bit easier for Biden to do something about it, then great. But I would also say, as someone who is naturally suspicious of Democratic leadership, Chuck Schumer, it's a little bit convenient of you that you think the path to dealing with the climate is Biden should do something. Well, sure, he should. He should. But you have to do stuff too, because you just became Senate Majority Leader again, and we sort of have expectations of you as a leader. Because it is easier for you to tell Biden to declare a climate emergency than for you to get rid of the filibuster so you can pass the Green New Deal, and to actually support the Green New Deal, or to whip the votes necessary to either do the one, the destruction of the filibuster, or passing the Green New Deal. Like, all of that stuff that Biden can do, whether it's in the form of executive orders or declaring an emergency or whatever, is good. But we can do multiple things at the same time. And you have to actually do something. If you want to be in leadership, you have to be a leader. And bringing it up at all is something. Doing it in an interview that many people are gonna watch is good, because it perhaps creates expectations on Joe Biden. So that's good. But it is not a get out of being a leader free card. That isn't actually how this works. And so if Chuck Schumer is gonna hold that position rather than offering it up to a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or whoever else might actually wanna wield the power a little bit more, that's potentially problematic. And we're gonna have to keep an eye on him too. In any event, it looks like we've hit the end of the hour. And Adrian, I want to thank you as always for joining us in this hour, especially for this episode. I'm happy to have you on for any day, but in this particular one, I don't know exactly what it would have been like without you. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And where can people watch more of your content?
So you can find me on Twitter at Adrian Law, Instagram at Adrian Lawrence, and on the Rebel HQ channels on Facebook and YouTube.
Awesome. Adrian, as always, thank you so much. So we had been planning to have a little talk here on the show about the possible raise to the minimum wage that could be coming. And what do you know? Breaking news got out in front of us and it suddenly became an even more timely topic. So we are very lucky in a timely fashion to be joined by once again on the show by the president of One Fair Wage and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Saru Jayaraman, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. I'm assuming you're pretty busy because today the Senate version of a bill to raise the minimum wage to about $15 an hour in the next 4 years or so is going forward. And I'm very interested in your thoughts on this effort, what the battle is going to be like, and the current state of that bill.
I mean, first, I think we have to understand how we got to this point. This didn't just happen because people on Capitol Hill or the president, you know, was feeling altruistic. Workers were organizing all of last year throughout the pandemic. Even during the pandemic, when it was dangerous, tipped workers, restaurant workers, other low wage workers were out in the streets. They were a big part of the Black Lives Matter protests. But they, even apart from that, held strikes in multiple cities saying, we cannot go back to work. We cannot work right now without a full livable minimum wage. A, we're not able to survive on these wages, nor does it make it worth it for us to go back to work and expose ourselves to the virus on these wages. But B, also, this economy cannot survive without people having the means to consume, to eat, to feed their families, to pay their rent, to pay their bills. I don't know where people think the consumption power that's needed to stimulate this economy from the place it is in now is going to come from if people don't have the means to survive. Mm-hmm. So that organizing is what led first to Joe Biden putting on his campaign platform a $15 minimum wage with full elimination of the subminimum wage for tipped workers, still $2.13 an hour, and full elimination of the subminimum wage for workers with disabilities. That then became, he said, a priority for him, but I think it was low wage workers turning out to vote to get him elected, and then low wage workers turning out in Georgia. And we mobilized tens of thousands of low wage workers to mobilize in Georgia to get also to deliver the Senate. And so the only reason this not only has been introduced, but can actually move and pass is because workers made it so. Low wage workers, people of color, women of color delivered the presidency and delivered the Senate to Democrats. And now Democrats have to deliver for them. They have to deliver a $15 minimum wage with tipped workers included and workers with disabilities included. And so it is extraordinary. It is groundbreaking. We are thrilled and deeply appreciative of the president for really driving this, and especially Senator Bernie Sanders, who's made sure that the $15 bill is part of that overall COVID relief package. But let's make no mistake, this happened not because of the electeds, but because workers had their voices heard.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We can be appreciative of the fact that it's something that apparently might happen.
Right.
But let's also not pretend as if, oh, you know, all the elected Dems have been supportive of this forever.
Right.
They haven't. They might not be now, actually, but they certainly weren't 4 years ago or 8 years ago or 12 years ago.
Supported for 150 years since emancipation, when tipped workers were black women who were hired by the restaurant industry and made to work for nothing. The last 150 years, we've seen a $2 increase over 150 years for tipped workers. So the fact that this is included in this bill is a testament to tipped workers, restaurant workers, and other low wage workers organizing.
And so what do you think about the current state of what's in the bill? The amount that they're set it to, the time it's going to roll over. There's apparently some sort of consideration for raises in the median wage that it'll be tied to. What do you think about what's in there and what's not in there?
That bill is, we've all got to keep emphasizing that bill is the least that Congress can do. It's the minimum we need, not the maximum. It's not a place to start negotiations. It's the end of negotiations. It includes $15 rolled in for non-tipped workers from $7.25 to $15 over 5 years, by 24 years, I guess, 2025. And for tipped workers from 2021 to 2026, 5 or 6 years. And so it gets everybody to $15. And then it after that, yes, wages continue to go up by what they call average wage growth. So it's not just inflation, it's how much everybody else's wages are going up. That's how much low wage workers' wages should go up as well. That is the least, because let's remember that the minimum wage, and especially the tip minimum wage, have been stagnated for decades. We all know that if the minimum wage had actually gone up with the cost of living, we'd be way higher, definitely upwards of $18 an hour at this point. And instead, we're stagnated at $7.25, and even more ludicrously at $2.13 for tipped workers. That has been stagnated for tipped workers at 30 years, for 30 years intentionally because of the power of the Restaurant Association. So this is the time to catch up. This is the time to actually push forward and actually get to 15 as quickly as possible, because we're so behind.
So a couple of things that you pointed out, you said, are the absolute minimum. And not a place to end up, like to start the negotiations from. But unfortunately, it looks like they are going to start the negotiations from that. So what do you think? Is that an assertion that we have such a strong position that we don't even need to highball them to begin with? Or are you worried that 2025 becomes 2029 and 15 becomes 1325? What do you think about that?
We need to focus on our peers, our Democratic colleagues. I am worried that there are moderate to conservative Democratic senators in particular who would push for a lesser wage, a regionalism, you know, a lesser wage in some parts of the country. And certainly they're going to face a lot of pressure from the Restaurant Association to actually carve out the tipped workers or have a lesser wage for tipped workers. And we need to collectively let those Democrats know, again, who delivered control of the Senate. It was low wage working women in Georgia. They delivered the Senate. It was their peers in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona. They delivered the Senate. And so the Democrats in the Senate need to deliver for them. Otherwise, they're going to lose control of the Senate in 2022. So this has got to be a time where they don't parse out pieces, make it less in some parts of the country. You know, I know you know this. I think your audience knows this. This is the most popular issue that exists among both Democratic and Republican voters. You know, let's look at what happened in Florida. 64% of voters, Republicans, voted to raise the wage to $15 an hour and the tip minimum wage to over $13 an hour. 12 percentage points more than Floridians voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
People overwhelmingly support this, and it's going to be hard for Republicans to vote no on it and go back to their communities. It's going to be even harder for moderate Democrats to try to cut it up and go back to their communities and get reelected. So we need the Democrats to deliver. Let this be the minimum. Let there be no negotiations. Follow your leader in President Biden and just go for a full minimum wage as it stands in the bill right now.
Yeah, he campaigned on it. Ossoff, Warnock both campaigned on it. They were very specific about it. We don't have to have these debates about what was a down payment and what eventually might. No, it was $15 an hour. That's what they actually said.
That's right.
And in terms of the path forward, I've seen some debate about whether, like, depending on how it's scored, they might be able to do it through budget reconciliation. Bernie seems to think that there's a chance that that could happen. If they don't, then it could potentially face a filibuster. I mean, what do you think about the how much of the Democratic caucus can we, if it ends up needing the 60 votes, can we count on? And are there 10 Republicans? Like, you talked about them potentially going home in shame to tell their constituents they voted down the minimum wage. I mean, they also stopped the minimum wage from being raised while they were in control of the Senate. So they seem to have been able to process that guilt so far. What do you think about these two different paths?
I think it's easier to message, oh, it didn't come up, so we didn't vote on it, as opposed to it came up and I voted no to raise your wages. Mm-hmm. I think that's a totally different thing. And so I think what I think is that there will be a vote that goes to the whole Senate. I think the Republicans will vote no per usual. I think they're going to have a tough time telling their communities why they did that. And then it will come down to budget reconciliation and 51 Democrats. And that's why I'm saying our focus has to be on Democrats to make sure that they stay unified around this bill as the least that they can do. Look, I want to make sure everybody understands, even among progressives, there's a ton of misinformation that has been spread about the minimum wage and the tip minimum wage. The idea that it kills jobs, that it necessarily, you know, reduces people's hours. The sub-minimum wage, the idea, the Restaurant Association has done such an incredible job convincing workers that raising wages would make tips go away. All of it is baloney. The states with the highest wages and that have no sub-minimum wage for tipped workers have higher rates of tipping. They have higher job growth. They have higher small business growth. All the corporations are growing faster in California and the states with $15 and a full minimum wage for tipped workers. So it's all misinformation, but it's misinformation that moderate to conservative Democrats might listen to, might roll over. And it's on us to make sure they hear from the people to say, don't you dare carve out anybody out of this bill. Again, in this pandemic, in this depression, this bill is the very least Democrats can deliver to the people who got them into office.
And you've been trying to make sure that they're heard. There's a demonstration going on today, correct?
There was a demonstration today on Capitol Hill. We had restaurant workers in front of the Capitol. We had a huge 24-foot statue of an essential service worker. We'll be back multiple times at the Capitol, but in actions all around the country, going to these senators' offices, letting them know we appreciate what's happened so far, and now we need them to take it across the finish line.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you'll be out there, you and so many others, with so much on the line. You'll feel free to come back on the show as we trace the progress of this bill. As someone who has worked in basically every corner of food service over my life, let alone, I mean, there's a lot of people who are non-tipped minimum wage workers, but that's a big portion of it. This is definitely something the country should be focused on. There's a lot of crises, but this is one of the biggest. Okay. And we look forward to talking to you about it in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.